My weekend was good. We own a motorhome, an RV, something we purchased during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Us and a million other American families. One thing I noticed is that a RV, when you're on an RV parking lot, you know, with all these big, massive buses, and the RVs look small. Like, you know, I'm going to buy the small one, you know, I'm not going to buy the multi-million dollar bus.
Yeah.
But then when you drive the thing home and you bring it home, you realize it's massive.
Yeah.
It only looked small because you were comparing it to other massive buses. So that's funny. That was really funny. My kids were very excited. This was about 2 years ago. I promised myself I would not buy an RV because I thought it was absurd to put a house on wheels. But you know, we have three kids, and the two reasons I decided to do it ultimately was, one, America's is massive. So if I want to drive to any of the national parks or anywhere, you got to cover great distances. So number one reason was to have the kids travel in comfort, you know, that they aren't squashed into the back seat, yes, but they are can, within reason, they can roam the house while we're driving. And the second reason was I can take the RV just, you know, down to the beach and spend the day at, like, local use. It doesn't always, yes, have to be crazy distances. So anyways, that was about 2 years ago. And I'm going to say I have mixed feelings today. I'm surprised at how often it breaks. You know, the plumbing, the electricity, yeah, the insulation, yeah, the assist. It wasn't made to land on Mars. It was made to just sit on wheels. Welcome to the CTO Podcast, a show dedicated to all the brave humans showing up in technology leadership roles around the globe. Every week, we'll help you keep track of the stories you missed, the trends that might pass you by, and talk to people that shape how we should show up as chief technology officers. I am your host, Etienne De Bruin, founder of 7CTOs, and joining me as always is the creator of Amazing CTO Newsletter, Stefan Schmidt. Let's go. I also realized that I need to... You know, it's almost like my relationship with my dog. It's a reflection of myself. Mm-hmm. How much I'm annoyed or irritated with my dog is a reflection on how I'm doing that day and how I feel in my head. You know? And the same with the RV. The less I invest in myself and, like, going, mm-hmm, places, and the more I am burning myself out through work, you know, the less time I spend with the RV, and so I have a sort of an ambivalent relationship with it.
Yeah.
So that's a long answer to say that we spent last week in the RV, 40 minutes away. Just, you know, it was nice. Sometimes it's nice to shrink the world's problems just into making the box work. Like, all the problems are out there, yes, and all I have to do is make sure we can cook, use the toilets, and, you know, be safe.
When you said it about the size of the RV, I'm reminded of a scene when me and my wife, we were on Corsica, and for one day essentially, and we sat in the harbor, and there was someone with a nice ship, nice boat, a yacht.
And a yacht, yes.
It was yacht. He was sitting there and enjoying, and like the harbor, Corsica. And then there comes some, and then another yacht came in, another boat came in, which was larger. And the person, you know, this on the larger, And you could see like the person on the smaller one was not so happy anymore, you know, like because it was a larger rowing ship and then they settled in the port. And then 10 minutes later, there came a huge yacht, a huge one, you know. And so you know, and I thought this is like, that's interesting. It's like the other two people were a bit happy for a brief moment
in time.
They had, yes. You know, and but then they sized themselves up to the other, you know, and they said, oh, well, this person must be happier because of a larger boat or something. It was so funny, like, to see in this 20 minutes of how it.
And they couldn't understand why these two Germans on the beach were just laughing their heads off, watching them.
Yes, we were so amused. I have no ship, and, you know, but it was so amusing.
There must be an evolutionary survival instinct in the signals that your brain processes when it sees something bigger. There must be there must be a mini model in our brains that are like, hey, hang on, what's going on here?
Yeah, I think so. So it's good to have self-reflection.
Yes. You wrote a newsletter. Are we discussing the stories from the last one or from the upcoming one?
No, from the next one, from the upcoming one. From,
rock and
from
roll.
The one from tomorrow.
Oh, you're going to publish it tomorrow?
I publish it tomorrow, yeah.
Okay, wow.
So we do it now and then I essentially finished and then... I publish it tomorrow noon or tomorrow, yeah, something like that.
Okay, perfect.
Early afternoon.
Yeah. Okay, let's jump in. Welcome to this week's CTO show.
Excellent. Love it.
We're going to call the CTO show. CTO show on YouTube and CTO pod on the podcast.
Yeah.
The CTO show is Stefan and I talking about a bunch of things that we think CTOs are talking about, should talk about, should be aware of. What I love about this idea is the pace at which CTOs are running, the bombardment of not only internal information, but external information. It's not always easy or sometimes fun to know, well, what should I be looking at? What's happening in the world? And I'm hoping that this show will in a fun conversational way, just keep people focused on some things that are happening out there. And Stefan is doing the research, also publishes this to the amazing CTO newsletter. Go subscribe to that. And come back for this. If you are on a run or walking your dog or buying an RV, you should be listening to this audio version.
First topic would be an article about how to measure developer productivity or how to measure developer performance, essentially. Everyone, and the point would be that everyone I know, every CTO I know, sooner or later, or on and off, the topic of developer performance management arises. And I thought this article is very interesting because it makes my point that, and the point of a lot of people, that pull requests are not a measure of performance. The number of pull requests are not a measure of performance, but there are many other things that you could measure for performance. And it's, I think it's really eye-opening, the article. It says a lot of things. For example, participation in meetings or participation in decisions. You know, so how do you participate in decisions? Something that people might not come up with as a measurement of performance of people, for example. And there are many more in there that I thought are very interesting. How do you think how is the topic of developer performance from your experience?
Let me ask you this. Why can't pull requests be a measure of performance?
The speaking with the article, the I think the main I don't want to misrepresent the article, but my understanding of the article at one point would be that developers don't think pull requests, the number of pull requests or the number of closed Jira tickets or something like that, or lines of code written are not measuring performance. And if you do not, if you try to measure performance in a way that the developer think is bonkers, you lose trust and they don't trust you in with all the other stuff that you're saying and doing, because obviously you do, you try to measure performance in a way that does not resonate with them. And I think it does not resonate with them. I think the easiest way is lines of code, for example, because you can write a lot of lines of code. You can few lines of code. I think many developers think, most developers probably think that if you solve a problem with less lines of code, that that's better for a lot of reasons. So having more lines of code as a measure of performance is does not make any sense to them. And I think from this base, the same goes for pull requests, like the number of pull requests. It's easy, can easily, you can have a lot of pull requests or you can have few pull requests. It's not correlate, there's no correlation with performance, you know. And I think from that point that the article makes, you should, as a manager, you should not do that.
Yes, the main point of this article is really quotes Goodhart's law, which is when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. So I can understand how if I say to my team, hey, we need one pull request from you a day, then, I mean, that's an easy, or if we're going to measure pull requests, then, you know, I can conceivably do a pull request once a day, two times a day, five times a day, and add to noise. I understand the idea that you can game the system, or, you know, that you can put a seemingly innocuous group of metrics together, and then the moment you do that, then the you know, the team starts to game the system, or like you said, they lose trust, and then they think, okay, well, why, you know, a bunch of smart people, why would I be measured this way? What I struggle with is there seems to be this resistance for measuring people's performance. You know, like if I have a team, or if I, you know, if I am constructing something, you can measure the performance. But because we are in a creative zone and software development is hard, it seems like there is a resistance to measuring performance. Do you see the same?
Yeah, I do. Kind of, I do see the same. So I'm a very competitive person, and I value performance very highly, and a performant organization very highly. But I would agree in principle that with what you said, and I disagree with the point. I agree with your point, but agree with the assumption that we should not measure performance. I think every CTO should look for a high performance organization and a high performance culture, and also tell people that they are working in a high performance culture, and also question things that he or she sees, or that they see that doesn't look performant to them. I've seen too many. Yeah, I think, yeah, it can be a bad thing, what you said. I see this sometimes, that people, that the just because lines of code is not a good measurement is used as an argument that you should not measure performance at all, you know, which I think is wrong. So yes, I think there should be a high performance. You should push for performance.
Yeah, the thing that I was thinking was, if only we could define a unit of work. You know, this might be a little bit off topic, but I was thinking about this yesterday, actually, as I was watching. I went to see Oppenheimer yesterday, and I was very inspired. But I was thinking how amazing would it be if our industry can define a unit of work? You know, so we can't do lines of code, we can't do pull requests, we all work in teams. You know, you don't have a direct impact necessarily on outcome. And yet we have this thing called JIRA, or we manage work according to tickets. And, you know, it's just, there seems to be a contradiction.
I've thought a lot about that in the last 20 years. I think we would first need to also need an understanding, that's a side quest, understanding of complexity, you know, because I think one of the challenges of software development is complexity. If I build a house, it just has three dimensions, and there's a limited number on how I can connect a wall to another wall, or I can connect a wall to other walls in general. Like I could connect a wall to, let's say, I don't know, realistically, four other walls. In software development, you can connect a wall to 1,000 other walls, you know, so it's totally different. I can connect a class, a service, to 1,000 other classes. So I think the main challenge already is how to define complexity, which is totally different from everything else we are doing. And I think the type of work is, I'm astonished a little bit. It's a pet peeve of mine, but I'm astonished that when you buy a razor. I don't buy, you buy a razor from a drugstore and from a supermarket chain in Germany, and there are huge differences in the performance of that razor, you know. So there are different brands, and not like Gillette, but like the lower brands, but they have very different performance. But nevertheless, all of these get built and sold. I think in software and also houses, like we co-built this house. There are very different houses, and they perform very differently. Nevertheless, everyone is more or less happy. I think with software, the difference in software is that we really, most of companies focus on impact and stuff like conversion and features. So it's a tremendous difference between building a good feature that gets you on a hockey stick, that goes viral and that's sticky, and a bad feature, you know, that's not that way. And it's built by the same persons and the same product management process, you know. So I think because the output is so widely different, people think, I think the input, like an input performance measure does not make as much sense as with other stuff, you know. You build a house and it takes 12 months, and then you have the house, and you might not be happy, or you might be happy, but you have the house. But with software, it's more fundamental, and perhaps because it's so soft, and it can be changed all the time, it's very different. And I think because a house is so hard, with concrete, that it's more important to define a deadline and a work size of work and a work unit, you know, because in the end everything's a house. You like it or you don't like it, but perhaps I see this sometimes with rented cars, because we rent cars, and so I see a lot of cars, a lot of different cars, and I think they are widely different usage wise. And I think software is different, and from that point of view, it makes hard to define something input driven as a work of unit of work.
It's like that developer on your team who says, oh man, I think if we refactor this library, or if we add this one functionality to this library, we can drastically help everybody's work.
Yes.
But they disappear for 2 weeks, or they don't follow the system of delivery. But yes. But what no one's ever going to really understand is the drastic impact that that engineer had on the rest of the team and the way they work.
Yeah.
You know, it's like in your house analogy, it's like one worker shows up and says, hey, if I do this one thing to the bricks, then all the workers will get to the bricks faster, and then the house will be more, you know, will be built, let's say, quicker. And that's not a great example because it's not about time. But will that person get the credit? Will the value that that person brought be fully understood? And so in my mind, I'm thinking, can we define a unit of work that has time as an input and value as an output? Can we reduce that to the smallest possible block? So if I work 2 hours, I get X value. If I work 3 hours, I get 2X value. But I hear your point, which is to measure that value is hard, because there's 1,000 different ways to do things.
Yes.
So my point, where I'm going at with this is just that I think that a lot of the metrics issues we have today with development is that in our companies, are we lazy or are we complacent about defining value? You know, we define it in terms of work that has to be done, but are we actually helping it by constraining the time so that the value can be more defined? So if we say ticket's going to be XL, ticket's going to be L, ticket's going to be 5, ticket's going to be 9, who cares? What I care about is in the unit of time that I allocate to a developer or the team, what value am I going to get from that? And I feel like the smaller that time allocation, the more definable that value is going to be. The more time you add, the more complex the output might be. I don't know. These are ways that I think about things, and I think it makes the whole metrics conversation hard for all of us.
It does. It makes it all hard for all of my coaches, essentially. It's a difficult discussion every time.
So let's highlight a few points from the article, which, you know, the author talks about some principles to follow when you're pursuing metrics. The first point was, instead of looking for a list of metrics to determine how you measure performance, figure out how you want to measure performance and then find metrics that help you measure the stuff that's important to your company. In other words, first look at outcome and what you want to achieve, and then the metrics versus finding the metrics to measure performance in a vacuum. Second one is focus on outcomes, not output, but you might use output metrics like activity from GitHub and Jira to debug why outcomes were missed. It might be appropriate to use team-level metrics to evaluate the performance of senior technical leaders and managers depending on their scope of responsibility. Watch out for Goodhart's Law and other cases where your metrics may encourage the wrong behavior. That's the one that everyone talks about. Metrics are one thing, but not everything. You still need to do the hard work of active performance management, setting expectations, giving regular feedback, and supporting your team.
I would like to add one more thing, or two more things. First thing is every CTO should read that article. I really think every CTO should read that article. And the second thing, kind of a wow moment was have a metrics of the tickets in your customer support system. So like if you have more, then developer gets paid less. So if you have unhappy customers and the amount of support tickets goes up, then your pay goes down. I think that's kind of obvious as a measurement, perhaps, but I would never have thought of that. So,
well, I think that there's some serious assumptions in that one. I'm not a fan of that.
Okay.
I think sometimes developers code something with purity and the best of intentions, but because they don't have the empathy or don't fully understand the impact, they make mistakes.
Yeah, they should have. Perhaps they should have more empathy.
It's like the DORA metrics conversation, which is the DORA metrics offers a set of benchmarks where you can benchmark your company. But the desire for the metrics is to drive behavior or to reveal behavior, which is a very different approach to what this article is saying. Because if I say I'm going to measure the number of times we deploy, a whole set of behaviors gets uncovered because of that. So I would actually encourage companies to adopt the DORA metrics, not as a way to try win at the game, but to just ask yourself, listen, if I'm only deploying 3 times a week, then my ability to respond to what the market wants or what the customers need or what customer support needs is debilitated or is hijacked. So there you have a metric, or you have a performance metric that is uncovering, oh my goodness, every time we deploy, Sally has to be on call. The owner has to sign off. The 5-page document has to be written. The security audit has to be done. All the keys have to be stored remote. You know, it's blah, blah. And then you realize, hang on, we have a very systemic problem in how we deploy based on a metric that showed us that we only deploy, you know, 3 times a week. So I think that this stuff all fits into an ecosystem of behavior. And I just, like you said, I think the problem is just way more complex than people think. And therefore, they think that there's a simple solution for performance management or performance measurement. And it really isn't simple. It requires a lot more effort. It requires a lot more conversation than you think. It requires 10 times more insight than you think you need. How your team is showing up, what the work cadence is, what the communication's like, what tool you're using, what problem you're trying to solve. I mean, there's just so much that goes into these things. It's not a simple thing. And I think the danger lies in when management comes in and says, well, we want to see the performance metric. It's not that simple. You need a CTO with deep insight, deep empathy, deep care for how this software is being crafted. And then on top of that, the metrics can be fantastic. This is definitely something we should keep on discussing in our CTO community. I want to talk to you about a network I founded over 10 years ago when I felt like I wasn't getting the support I needed from other CTOs. I was concerned that I wasn't getting a soundboard. My ideas were amazing to me, but I was concerned that maybe they were biased towards my own experiences. And really, as my whole company looked to me to build out their technology organization, I felt concerned. Was I getting the education I needed? Was I getting the pushback that I needed? And I wasn't getting that from my fellow C-suites because they were not technical. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to jump in and create a network where we all have to come with our authentic selves and share our insecurities, our challenges, and face the next level of scale. We all know that what used to work 6 months ago isn't necessarily going to work 6 months from now as we are constantly growing our organization. So 7CTOs is a peer network of hundreds of CTOs who get together once a month in groups of 6 or 7 to learn something new together, to process some challenges together, and then really to just encourage each other on this journey. We assemble people at the same levels. We use a proprietary framework called CTO levels to make sure that people are actually peers. And my goal is to have those 4 or 5 hours you spend with that group every month be the most valuable time-saving hours that you can spend. Don't go down the rabbit holes. Don't wallow in insecurity. Don't be angry for too long. Come and get that support that you need. It is a lonely place. It is a high stress environment. So 7CTOs is literally the tech people who are all also taking on the growing of companies. We do our forum meetings, deep dive calls, retreats, conferences. Head over to 7CTOs.com, hit the apply button, and we'll get you into a forum within 30 days. That is our guarantee. Love to see you there. See you soon. I feel like I want to come up with or want to collaborate with someone on, I see a little square in my brain and I see time and I see value and I see the product of that is effort. So if I have to work on a big ticket or if I'm a part of a team that's trying to solve a big problem, is it possible for us to break it down into the smallest blocks of time and value? What's next, Stefan?
Next one is the article is called The Most Efficient and Environment-Friendly Programming Languages. And it's a little discussion about paper, which looks into how much energy a programming language uses.
Hmm.
And I found that article interesting for two reasons. The first reason is that developers don't care, at least from my experience. And the second reason is that a lot of my CTO coaches get into sustainability. And they, some of them start easy, like calculating energy consumption on AWS and things from their usage. But a lot of them get pressured into measuring this as a topic because it's important to the CEO, it's important to the board, and for various reasons. So, and I think this is like developers don't care, but there is a drive for sustainability and energy consumption in providing services. Mm. And I think this article about programming languages, which programming languages are more energy efficient compared to others, is kind of a bridge between these two.
I wonder if cloud services would start charging based on this, charging more or less. They don't. I wonder if people will start caring if the cloud providers start saying, hey, you know, a C image is cheaper than a Perl image, you know?
I think the drive could come when enough companies do this and say something like, I don't know even if where to start, how to compare services for sustainability and energy consumption, but let's assume they say something, we have an A rating based on something I don't know, and others say we have a B rating. And then it might be the challenge might arise that the CEO of the company with the B rating goes to the CTO and says, why do we have a B rating? And the CTO says, we have a B rating because we use Python. We use Python because it's most advanced for AI or for whatever reasons, or we get the most developers. But if they would change to Rust, they would immediately go from B to A. And that's a very interesting dynamic that could arise. I don't know if it does arise, but that's, I think, is a very, could be a very interesting dynamic that arises where there's a push. Currently, developers choose programming languages just as they like. And there could be a push in the future from the board to the CEO, to the CTO, to use more sustainable, energy efficient programming languages. I'm not even sure if it can be measured the way the article reflects on that, but assuming it can be measured, there could be a drive, and I think this will open up a very interesting dynamic.
This is very interesting, especially if you consider embedded systems. You know, if we're all starting to talk about AI and self-contained units, you know, I could see, you know, because look, energy efficiency means battery power. So, you know, if I'm building a system that is going to be driven by a lithium battery or something, you know, then obviously this is a very important conversation. This is from the article. It says on average, the compiled languages consumed 120 joules to execute solutions, while for virtual machine languages and interpreted language, the value was 576 joules and 2300 joules respectively. So compiled 120, virtual machine 500, and interpreted language 2300 joules. I mean, that is fascinating if you consider, I mean, that's why embedded systems are probably, you know, they're in C, C++. Then this trend can also be observed in the case of execution time, as compiled languages required 5,000 milliseconds, virtual machines 20,000 milliseconds, and interpreted languages almost 90,000 milliseconds on average. I mean, these are important things, you know? I mean, if you consider interpreted languages, I mean, it's dynamic typed languages mostly that runs through the interpreter, runs through the compiler, I mean the runs through the just in time compiler, whatever. You know, I would say these are really important considerations. Not so much from an energy efficiency, maybe, but I mean, that execution time alone, I mean, I would want my apps or my code to run as quickly as possible. So on the list, we have the top languages for energy efficiency, energy use. Number one, no surprise, C. I was birthed in C. Rust, second, C++ is third, Ada is fourth. Java is fifth. So Java coming in at roughly 2 times the energy usage of C, but a lot better than most of the languages that follow, which is just name a language. And then for execution time, C is the top, Rust is at the top, C++, Ada, Java. So it's the same cats. And then in terms of megabytes, what is the megabytes? Oh, memory consumption. Pascal is number one. Wow. And then Go. Go is one of my favorite languages.
Mine too.
Huh.
But I think the dynamic is really interesting if it takes off, because like up to now, the CEO does not care a bit what programming languages you use. You know, so CTO, development, the developers are free to choose whatever they want to do. But if we get a sustainability drive with a discussion into tech, which I see started on AWS consumption and AWS energy estimations, then suddenly this would be very unsettling for developers if the CEO tells them via the CTO what programming language to use. That would be something very, very uncomfortable, I think. For that reason, I found it very interesting. Well, another article, next one is Open the Code Base to Everyone. So the name of the article is called Opening the Code Base Up to Everyone. And the content of the article is the idea is described by the author in his startup that essentially anyone in the organization who wants to write code can write code.
Wow.
And I found that kind of as a concept and an idea kind of eye-opening or mind-extending. I don't know. But I've also not think about the silos and compartmentalized departments and things. And just the idea that if you can open a Git account, if you can go and get added to the repo, then you can write code. And it goes into code review and things. And then it gets published.
Yeah, I see all sorts of opportunities, and I can already see all sorts of rebukes and resistance from the dev team. Of course, the key here is anybody who wants to. So of course, in the company, there's going to be a bunch of people who don't want to. So what I love here is, hey, we're a team of 50 people. Our dev team is 15 people, and there's 6 or 7 people who are really interested in, well, how did we write that query? Or why is this piece of code always causing issues, or this function in the product? So I love the idea that you're opening the code to everyone. Secondly, I love the idea of safeguards in your software development process that will obviously prevent someone from merging code without any approval. So it sounds like there's a lot of training involved. You have your processes well defined, and secondly, you need to have a lot of training about, well, this is how, hey, go take a look at the code, this is how we do our development life cycle. So, you know, I think thirdly, you have then of course the quality issue or how a problem gets solved. And presumably the non-coder isn't going to solve the most complex problem in the system. Maybe they will. You know, I'm a huge fan of diversity and diverse thinking and diverse backgrounds. And, you know, how often have you spoken with someone who is not at all in your domain? You take the time to articulate the issue to them, and then they ask you a question that is perplexing. And you're like, why did you ask me that? And your brain resists, and then your brain is like, hang on, that's actually a great question. It was dumb when you first heard it, but now, you know, it fires off a whole different part of your brain. This we talk about this all the time, Stefan, you know, like ChatGPT and LLMs, like stimulating different thinking. And if you can rely on your own people in your own company to come with, well, should the query first get the customer IDs, but don't we just need their shoe sizes? And you're like, well, hang on, why are we loading all of these? Yeah, I guess we could just do it that way, you know? So I absolutely love this idea.
Me too. And also, I might add, of all for the reasons you said, I might add two more from my perspective. I've been doing coding for manager workshops in the past to open up, to get a broader understanding of what programming means in a startup, in a company. So it's like a startup is depending on the programming done, but there is a very shallow understanding of what programming is inside the company. So I did coding for manager workshops to get a broader understanding of what coding is and what programming is. And I think when you do this, everyone can code. I think you get a more identification with the company as a tech startup. You know, it's not, you know, so you spread the idea of we're a tech startup, we're a tech company to the whole of the company. You know, and other people feel it. It's not like they only know it, but they feel it because they could write code too. And perhaps they write a bug fix. You know, they might write a bug fix and then never code again. I talked to a friend who worked on a campaign, had as a project manager on a campaign and saw all these on a project. And then there was an ad campaign. And he went through the city and said, oh, I worked on that one. And I think something like that could happen here too. Oh, I fixed that bug.
Mm.
And it spreads the understanding of being a tech company to everyone.
Mm.
And the second idea would be that it breaks down silos. It's not, sometimes I see the silo and I use it to my benefit. You know, often when I talk to HR about performance measurements and stuff like that, HR says, oh yeah, you're developers, you're different. You can't be put into the same pot as everyone else, you know? And there are sometimes I intentionally created to my own benefit silos, but there are silos created. I think this is a way to break down silos and hierarchies and get everyone involved.
Yes. And before people run with this in the wrong direction, to give some perspective from the article, in 2023, 53 people contributed code to their repo. Five of those were these non-programmers. So it's, you know, it's not like we're talking about, you know, the whole company coming in and attacking the code base. How often have you had that feeling in you where someone's like, oh, I will do this work? And you're like, no, I'll do it. Because in your brain, you think that person clearly doesn't understand how complex this issue is. So I'm just going to, or I have to schedule a meeting with you to explain to you, you know. So there's so much of that. Like I said earlier, there's so much opportunity for teams to relax and learn from each other and spend the time to explain. So I see this as a fascinating way to help people, the development team, get better. You know, the development team to get, like you said, the HR team that says you guys are special. But to have the development team learn skills in communication, in teaching, in being gentle, in fueling people's curiosity, in creating a safe environment. I mean, these are all things that the whole team will benefit from.
Yeah.
And I see this method that this team used as a fascinating way to do that. So a couple highlights from their experience. Several account managers taught themselves SQL and used it to build ad hoc reports and dashboards in a tool called Metabase. They built a feature enabling them to embed these in the product so they can improve the in-product experience for their customers. Next one, an implementation team member built several single sign-on integrations with platforms like Azure, because he found it easier to build it himself than go back and forth between the customer and the developers. And then I love this one. Salespeople have learned how to build and connect their API to other services via Zapier or Retool. This made it easy to build simple proof of concepts, which sometimes turned into fully fledged features. Once a salesperson built an entire feature on top of Zapier, and once they were totally confident in the business logic, they rebuilt it into the product. I mean, that is just gorgeous. And then the last one, a former lawyer learned enough Ruby to contribute bug fixes to their legal compliance product. He was able to combine huge domain expertise with just enough coding knowledge to be very effective. The most interesting thing was how much easier collaboration became once the subject matter expert could read and write unit tests. It's gorgeous. That's a nice find.
I think so too. Last one, short one. There was this article on Wix starting a new feature, and which is creating a whole website from an AI prompt. So they launched
no a brainer.
Feature that you can build the whole website by describing it on an AI prompt.
This has to be where the world goes to in the next few months.
You know, and we have had a discussion how long do we have developers and things. So I thought this was it's just a website, kind of low functionality, most presentation. But I think it's a kind of a milestone.
Absolutely. I really think that this is where we have to go. The first target for LLMs needs to be the creation of markety whatever websites. Like, it just makes so much sense because websites have been optimized to have best practice sitemaps. So it's, why do I have to go and create all these things if I can have a conversation with a service to just go and build it? Hey, I want to add a blog post, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, we're all, I mean, what I think is more powerful is I need to add a couple photos to my gallery that depicts my summer vacation, you know, or my team's offsite, you know, and
done.
Go find the photos at our Google Drive. Boom.
Don't. That's too much.
That's.
I need some photo, astonishing photos from our offsite for the team page. Add them. Thanks.
Boom.
I struggle sometimes to say please and thank you to ChatGPT because I do this, you know, and say please do that, and then you know, and I say thank you. It's kind of ridiculous, but well.
No, I think this is very exciting. And you know, I don't see this as the demise of the developer. I see this as the demise of agencies who for far too long have gotten away with charging people way too much money for the basics.
Yeah.
Now I'm not talking about the agencies who've realized that website building is the commodity and that the real IP or the real intellect is how do I acquire more customers, you know, or how do I push my message to more people, you know. But the website itself has to be something that no one thinks about anymore. And then I wonder what the evolution is of that, you know, if because ultimately the website, the machine or the LLM now creates a website that is consumed by who? By a person or by a search robot or by another LLM scraping the internet. I mean, it's just the snake eating its tail situation. It has to converge onto some, like I said in my last show, I think we're just moving towards a world where there just are no apps. There are no websites. Yeah. It's not necessary. You just talk to the ghost in the machine and it will just give you the information you need.
Yeah. As last time, I agree this time. So I agree. And I mean, and you're saying clever things. I agree. So that's it.
Sometimes I listen back to myself and I'm like, man, I should just be careful what I say. There's a lot of stuff.
Yes. Yes, but then who listens?
Hey, we have two or three people listening.
No, we have a lot of people listening. It's taking off, which we have a lot of people listening. But I have to, sometimes at a conference, that after a conference talk, I thought, oh, what have I said? Hopefully my boss is not listening to something, you know, or someone from HR is not listening. I sometimes tell too many truths. Sometimes they need to be told then. I'm telling them.
Great. So let's end the show. That was wonderful. It's always wonderful to see you. I do want to ask you a question. I'll end the show here. There you have it, another episode of the CTO podcast. If you like the show, let us know. Like and subscribe on YouTube and subscribe to us in your favorite podcast app. It'll be amazing to keep this community growing. If you want to talk to us, we're on Telegram. Go check out CTO Podcast on our Telegram group. And of course, you can always hit us up on Twitter. I am ETDEBRUIN. And Stefan is King of Coders, KingofCoders. Please head over to 7CTOs.com. Check out the most favoritist, amazingest community of CTOs on the internet and in the world. And also go check out AmazingCTO.com and subscribe to the newsletter. This is what makes the show possible, is all the amazing research and work that Stefan does to make this show happen. We love all of you, and please, let's see you next week. Cheers.